Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, that was a spellbinding interview we had the last hour and 15 minutes. We're getting ready to bring on the one and only Bitter Ender, Gene Andrews. He's still bitter, Bitter Ender, more bitter than ever. But when we go to the Bitter Ender, I'm going to read this, the back. I have a book here. This has for the last hour and 15 minutes. The book Mr. Buddy gave me, Setting the Record Straight. Letters from Cell Number 7 by Political Prisoner Ernst Zundel. Okay, here's what it says on the back. This is just some of the stuff that he had to go through in the Canadian legal system. And people, if it's not already here, it's coming here. Here he goes. The law under which I am held in here is very complex. Only recently updated law passed by the Canadian Parliament after the 9/11 terrorist attacks and their aftermath. That should be a big clue. After the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we could talk about that later, but we probably won't have time. The law allows a Canadian judge of the federal court to listen to secret witnesses, secret evidence, and look at documents, listen to videos, audios, anything at all. My attorney or I will not be told the names of these witnesses. We cannot test the documents to see if they're forged, edited, or what have you. Therefore, we cannot make intelligent submissions about these documents in my defense. The judge's decision is final. It cannot be appealed or reviewed by a higher court, not even the Supreme Court of Canada. Ernst Zundel, political prisoner. Go back to you, Bitter Ender. I just wanted to push that out there because I think probably we in the South probably suffered through some of the same stuff after during Lincoln's War. But anyway, I just want to throw that in from what we did for the last hour. Go ahead. So what are we going to talk about tonight, Bitter Ender?
No, that's true. That's exactly how they get these cases through the courts. And it's so ridiculous. To me, you know, it goes to prove that the whole hoax was a hoax. Because if you have to have laws that ridiculous, and if you can't, I know like in Germany they say you can't use facts to defend yourself in a trial where you were accused of denying the absurd numbers that they pull out of the hat for the whole hoax. To me, that's your first clue that right there that the thing is false. It's a false narrative. If you have to arrest people and put them in jail for bringing up factual information, then you don't have a case. You have a dictatorship, or you have these Soviet show trials or something like that. So regardless of any other type of information, I know the scientist has gone over and taken soil samples from where these supposed gas chambers were, and there have been a lot of people that have found a lot of these documents and these claims that these people were, you know, it seems like everybody that has a Jewish grandparent was in a concentration camp. And yes, must have had a gazillion and a half of those things going according to everybody that claims they were there. So regardless of all that, the trials are what are the red flag to me that the whole thing is a fake. That if you can't use factual information in a trial to defend yourself, then that's telling me that whatever scenario or whatever story they're trying to cram down your throat is totally false. Because the truth can stand on its own two feet. It's lies that have to be covered up in the courts and in attacks and censorship and public embarrassment, humiliation, and things like that. Those are lies right there. That's the only way that a lie can keep going. And so, I don't know. I think they're their own worst enemies to me anyway, and some of this stuff they come up with to falsify their narrative about the Holo hoax. So, anyway, that's my two cents worth.
It's just amazing. I mean, this, in other words, I mean, this is what they said, this excerpt on the back of this book. The judge can say, oh, we have this document that you can't see, you can't verify it, but we have one, though. You got to take our word for it. We wouldn't lie. And it says that you got caught, killing an old lady trying to cross the street. But we have it. You can't look at it. You can't see it. You can't see the witnesses, but it's true because we say it's true. And it's that, you know, it may not be that blatant here yet, Gene, but the so-called January 6th.
To push it. Well, yeah, yes. Look at January 6th, what they're doing to those people. They exactly. Throw them in jail. They suspend the writ of habeas corpus. They just lock them up, and hopefully the blacks will kill them while they're in that hellhole prison in Washington. So. Yeah,
that's the way that works.
It's a joke. It's a joke.
Yes, it is.
The legal system in this country has really gone down the toilet. And they have all these screwball judges. Every time they hand down a decision that's against somebody that's conservative, the news media always says, well, this judge was appointed by President Trump, so he's got to be right, or she. They've got to be right. They were appointed by Trump. Well, not necessarily. Trump didn't go around and personally know these people and vet these people and personally swear them in himself. Any president can't do that. I mean, they're, you know, federal judges all over the country, and he can't know every single one of them and know which ones are, you know, claim to be conservative. And if you go back and dig through all their court cases, they're not. But the news media really enjoys any of these prosecutions of conservative people, the January 6th people, or anything like that, or the people that questioned the election. I can't understand in Georgia how they get 18 people on trial with Trump for that, for questioning whether there was voter fraud in Georgia. And while we're on the subject, all the prosecutors are these fat black women, you know. It
yes.
looks like
yes.
Aunt Jemima lookalike contest or something. So, and of course, we know how they got there. George Soros bought their way in. So that's easy to figure that one out. But it's so insulting to see the government of this country and how it operates. And like they say, that old saying that a fish rots from the head. So look what's ahead of this government in this country, and you know how rotten it is and how corrupt it is, and you know you got this election stealing incompetent drooling idiot running the government, so it just trickles downhill, I guess. So anyway, that really wasn't what we're going to start talking about today.
That's true. I'd like to say one more thing. One thing that broke my heart is, I don't know if you remember Sidney Powell. She was I think she was from Texas. I sent her. Yep. I tried to get her to come on our program. We came so close to getting her. But then, you know, now she's, I think they broke her. She's just a broken lady. I saw her crying on the TV, you know, on YouTube or whatever, because they were after her so, so bad. I mean, hell, Gene, they're putting the lawyers in prison that tried to. So here's this, before I leave that subject. Where are they going to get if somebody like us, I mean, even Trump, I mean, but if he's having a hard time getting an attorney, if they're putting his attorneys in jail, what if you or I or Miss Nancy or somebody is confused of a hate crime? Where the hell are we going to get one? They're going to be scared to come to our aid. If they're putting Sidney Powell, I mean, hell, Sidney Powell was brilliant, man. She was great. But anyway, I'll shut up now. So, Sister Nancy, I'm turning the hope, well, I didn't mean to get off on that, but I was so, so moved by Fred Leutcher's his testimony in the last 75 minutes. So tell us, before we go to a break, we got about a minute or so. Tell the people, our beloved Blood River Radio family, where we're going. I'm bowing out. My time's over.
Well, I think Fred did a great job, and I commend him. He's certainly paid the price. Anybody who tells the truth nowadays or questions the facts or comes up with bad facts that the government doesn't like, they're going to suffer. Especially, well, let's put it this way. The Jews are going to make you suffer. I think Gene and this is going to be our Confederate hour, and I think Gene is going to talk about something that happened in February. It was a battle that took place in Tennessee. And I was going to talk about a real distant cousin who I found in my research for Quantrill's Men. And I had no idea that I even had a relative who rode with Quantrill, but I was going to explain a little bit about his life and death.
Well, Sister Nancy, you probably hear the music. We got to go to our first break of the third hour. Dear people, hang on to your seats. We'll be right back with the Bell Cow and the Bitter Ender. So be right back.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these this means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging out. Now we're going to go right back to, we're in the Confederate History Hour now. We wear a lot of hats on Blood River Radio. So we're going to go right back to the Miss Bell Cow, and she's going to take us off on her and the Bitter Ender and the rest of this hour. Go ahead, Sister Bell Cow.
You're not very clear. I can't hear you very well, Eddie.
You can't?
Okay.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Okay. I was going to start out by actually telling the listener something about one of my distant cousins who was a Confederate. I started out doing research on the executions that took place here in Kentucky under Burbridge. Many of them were, of course, people that really were not involved with any crime, but they were held as prisoners and they were executed in 1864 and 1865. During that time, I found out about the activity of local guerrillas or partisan people who were active in the state of Kentucky in the latter part of the war. And they connected with the Quantrill's Men who crossed in from Missouri into Kentucky, into the western part of Kentucky, in the about the spring of 1865. Now, the reason Quantrill, believe it or not, he was a Yankee. He was born in Canal, Dover, Ohio. But he must have been a very charismatic leader, and Southerners followed him. He made the attempt to come into Kentucky hoping that he could successfully cross the state of Kentucky and surrender with Lee. Now, the reason they would—they knew they could not surrender in Missouri. They would have, in fact, Jesse James had offered to surrender, and of course, the Yankees shot him. He did survive, but that was the kind of retribution that anybody who was a Confederate, especially a partisan, guerrilla, anyone who was active in Missouri was not going to be able to surrender, and Quantrill knew that. So he came into the state of Kentucky hoping to get into Virginia, but it really, that didn't work out for him. What happened is he was confronted by many different federals in the state. There were in different locations. When I was doing this research, I had no idea that I had any connection to Quantrill or his men. In the state of Kentucky, many, many Kentuckians moved into Missouri in the 1820s and 1830s. In fact, I say that the blood that was shed during our war for Southern independence in Missouri was lots and lots and gallons of Kentucky blood, because our people were the Yeagers, the Youngers, the Boones, the Muirs, the Wattses, and they were the people who were doing a lot of fighting in Missouri. That would be in the 1860s. My interest was piqued when I found out that I had a captain who rode with Quantrill. And it goes back to the county of Washington County in Kentucky, where Judge James Yeager was from. He, his sister and brother, all settled around Blue Springs and Independence, Missouri area. James Yeager was elected judge for Jackson County about five times. He and his wife had one son. That was Richard Dick Francis Yeager, and two daughters. They created a hauling business in addition to him being a judge, in which Dick Yeager would take these supplies 800 miles into Mexico territory, which was actually Santa Fe at that time. And they would go down the Santa Fe Trail, and they would exchange their products for goods such as mules in Mexico. Well, the Jayhawkers raided Judge Yeager's home and took the freight from their property. This led to son Richard Yeager, my distant cousin, joining up with Quantrill. And he led a famous raid into Council Grove, Kansas, from Missouri. That was 130 miles on horseback from, say, Westport, around Kansas City, into Council Grove. When he arrived there with his own men, and he was not led by Quantrill, he was a captain of his own men. In the May of 1863, he was suffering with a bad toothache. Since he knew the people in Council Grove, because the Santa Fe Trail goes through Council Grove. In fact, I was in Council Grove on a horse ride, or part of a horse ride, and I was bragging about the fact that my cousin had been there and saved the town. But Dick Yeager promised that he would not raid the town if he could see a dentist and have his tooth extracted. So they went ahead and worked on this. This is a true story. This really happened. And so they extracted his tooth. Well, he knew people in Council Grove, like I say, because he had been on the Santa Fe Trail hauling through the Santa Fe Trail. It goes right through Council Grove. So what did they do? They went and sacked another town called Diamond Springs. So, anyway.
That's like what the bitter ender would have done.
So he lived up there. Yeah, that's what he promised, and that's what he did. He was at the Battle of Independence, Missouri, and he was also at the Battle of the takeover of Lawrence, Kansas, which the Yankees are still crying about. Lawrence, Kansas, when no women were killed. No children were killed. They were looking for Jim Lane, who ran and got underneath a porta potty or an outdoor toilet and hid. Anyway, that's the tale they tell. Anyway, they killed only men. They couldn't get a hold of Jim Lane, who is a raider on the groups into Missouri. I went to visit Arrow Rock, Missouri. It was a little town. It's actually west of Independence. It's west of Kansas City. Very small town, population 79. And Yeager and a group of men with Todd, George Todd, they had run through the town, and I guess they were going to attack a building in which there were some Federals inside the building, which the building is still standing. I saw the building. And unfortunately, my cousin was the only one shot. That was August of 1863. He was taken into what you would call a guerrilla hospital. And a guerrilla hospital was you were hidden in a field and left. So they left him in a field. He was nursed by either Jenny or Laura Flannery at the Gillum Farm. Now, the Yankees found him about 2 weeks later and killed him in the field. Jenny or Laura Flannery was what she did. She came forward to the damn Yankees and confessed that she had been nursing Dick Yeager. And they immediately arrested her. Now, the reason if anybody does the research in Missouri, they're going to find out a lot of women got arrested in Missouri, a lot of women. So the reason she did that was to protect Gillum, who was the owner of the farm where they were hiding this wounded Confederate. And my ancestor, Richard Yeager, people had marked various Confederates, and I'm assuming that Dick Yeager was buried probably temporarily right there around Arrow Rock or maybe on the Gillum Farm. I'm not quite sure where he was. I think he was probably buried or thrown into a ditch right around there. Years later, when I started doing the research on this distant cousin, people said they didn't know where he was buried. Well, I found him. He was buried, actually, in an unmarked grave in Forest Hills in Kansas City, and I had him marked with a VA marker at the cemetery there, along with another Confederate who they were not sure where he was buried. But I want to read something to the listeners to give you an idea of what was going on, and I'll end it with this. There's a lot of information from a site called the Watt Hayes Letters, in which these people were related to Dick Yeager's family. And so these were letters that were transcribed and copied, and they're fascinating letters. They're actual letters. And this is a letter that was written about Dick Yeager. It said, "They have taken some families prisoners. Dick Yeager father-in-law." Now that's, in other words, Dick Yeager's father-in-law's family. They've taken his family because Dick Yeager was on the run. Dick Yeager's wife and child, they have taken them to Leavenworth. Now, that's prison. There were seven women in the family. They were accused of feeding bushwhackers. Dick's wife was taken to spite him. They say if they get Dick, they will torture him for 4 days and then burn him. That is what was going on in Missouri.
Well, it was all to preserve the Union, so I guess they consider that's okay.
The lady who composed wrote some of these letters, you know what they did with her? Upton Hayes, I think, was her husband. They forced her out of her own home, and she got her children out, and they forced her to burn her own home down.
Nice people.
Sister Nancy, we've got to go to a quick break. I don't know if you hear the music, but as soon as we come to that soon as we get through this break, we'll come back with the bitter ender and get his take on what you just said. Be right back, folks.
Pursuing liberty. Using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News. I'm Laura Winters. It's primary day in South Carolina with voters heading to the polls, IVF becoming a campaign issue. Former President Trump campaigning in South Carolina Friday night, saying he strongly supports in vitro fertilization.
I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious little beautiful baby. I support it.
Vice President Kamala Harris responding, the vice president blaming Trump for Alabama becoming the first state to say that frozen embryos qualify as children under state law. Harris speaking in a video posted online.
Donald Trump says that he wants to protect IVF. Don't get distracted from the facts. He literally is the architect of this entire crisis. What happened in Alabama is a direct result of what happened in the United States Supreme Court.
Volkswagen recalling 260,000 cars due to a fire risk. USA's John Schaefer with details.
The car manufacturer indicates that compact cars in the U.S. might experience a fuel leak from a pump inside the gas tank. The recall affects Volkswagen Golf, Golf GTI, Golf Sportwagon, Jetta, and Audi A3 models that were produced between 2015 and 2020. As of now, no fires have been reported due to the issue. I'm John Schaefer.
The Biden administration implementing more than 500 sanctions against Russia in response to the mysterious death of Russian opposition leader Navalny and Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. President Biden saying Russian President Vladimir Putin must face consequences for his aggression.
We in the United States are going to continue to ensure that Putin pays the price for his aggression abroad and repression at home.
And I'm Laura Winters, USA News.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Deutsch, and if you or your business owe money to the IRS, I've got great news for you. Tax laws have changed. Billions of dollars are earmarked for IRS Fresh Start programs, and if you qualify, you can literally save tens of thousands of dollars. Listen, I know what you're going through. Call me if you want to speak with a tax attorney or tax professional for free.
800-284-9275. That's 800-284-9275. Do you have a story to tell? Bring your story to life with audiobooks. Great stories deserve great storytelling. Audiobook Network provides professional voice actors and full production services for every author's manuscript. From narration, production, and editing to distribution, promotion, and sales, Audiobook Network handles everything. If you have a print book, ebook, or even a manuscript, call Audiobook Network now and get our free audiobook guide. 800-734-1229. 800-734-1229.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging out with this stuff. We're getting ready to get into the crux of another fascinating a history picture. It's not just like a lesson. I mean, it's like going to a movie that you can't see, you know, a verbal movie. Anyway, we're going to go back to the Bitter Ender now. He's been hanging out listening to Sister Nancy. So go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we had talked earlier in the week, since this is our last program in February, we would like to cover some Confederate events that took place during the month of February. And we had talked about some of these earlier, about the formation of the Confederate government. And the first government of the Confederacy, the provisional government of the Confederacy, of course, was formed in February of 1861 in Montgomery, Alabama. And to set up the new country, they elected a president, Jefferson Davis, of course, Vice President Alexander Stephens. They elected representatives and senators to the Confederate Congress. They drafted a constitution, which we had talked about, all the things that they had changed. And not a whole lot, but quite a few things in the original constitution. And one of the things they defined who we the people are. It said we're the representatives of the several states assembled. So that's what they were emphasizing. It was the states that were setting up the government and not a federal dictatorship. They printed money, postage stamps. Interesting thing here, a little side note to that, the Confederate Postal Service, the Postmaster General was John Regan of Texas, although he was born in Gatlinburg. And they used to have a sign up there in Gatlinburg in East Tennessee on that main street in Gatlinburg saying that that was where John Regan was born, and he was later Postmaster General of the Confederate States of America. I'm sure they've probably taken that down now because they don't want to upset any of the tourists coming in there, but that's where he was born, in Gatlinburg. But the Confederate Postal Service operated during 4 years of war. They never had a rate increase, and they never went back to Congress for bail. Maybe the U.S. Postal Service could take some lessons from the Confederate Post Office, learn a little bit from them. And then you go forward to 1862 in February, and the permanent government of the Confederacy was put in place. So the first year was just provisional. The president had a one-year term. A lot of the generals in the army, you see the rank of provisional general or provisional brigadier general or whatever. They only had a one-year term, and it automatically expired at the end of a year. And then that way, if whoever they selected for president wasn't doing a very good job, they didn't have to impeach him. They just had to wait out a year, and then he'd be automatically gone, and they could have elected somebody else. But they thought Jefferson Davis was doing well enough, they would give him a regular term, which in the Confederate Constitution was a six-year term, because they didn't want the president spending his last 2 years in office worrying about getting elected for the next four. So they just gave the president a six-year term, but you could only be president once. So you better get it right the first time, because you weren't going to get another chance. And then a couple of the other things now, by that time, of course, the Confederate government had been moved from Montgomery up to Richmond after Richmond seceded. And it was Lincoln that actually was responsible for almost doubling the size of the Confederate States of America. There were only seven states in the Confederate States of America until Lincoln sent the fleet into Charleston Harbor. And he actually admitted to his cabinet and some of the officials in Washington, he needed to provoke a war and have the South fire the first shot so he would have an excuse to declare war against the seven states and send the federal armies in there and force them back into the Union, because he knew darn well if they left them alone, they weren't coming back, and they could make all kind of deals and dangle things out in front of them to sucker them back in. And one of the things that people never bring up on television is the Corinth Amendment. There was a representative Corinth of Ohio who had an amendment to the Constitution which passed the U.S. Congress in 1861 after the Southern states seceded, and that amendment protected slavery in the U.S. Constitution. So if the Southern states had been all about slavery as they claim today and had come back into the U.S. Union, and they got seven votes there, and they already had four votes of states that were still in the Union up north. And so you get those seven and enough to get the two-thirds to make it an official amendment to the Constitution, then slavery would have been protected in the U.S. Constitution. And it would have taken another amendment then to try to abolish it, which had been very difficult at that time. But that wasn't why the Southern states stayed out. So when Lincoln sent the fleet to Charleston, said that they were going to shut down the port of Charleston and make Fort Sumter a duty station where any ship could come in to Charleston or the Confederate states, but they would have to stop and pay taxes to the United States to come to a port in the Confederate states. And the Confederates said, yeah, I don't think we're going to let that happen. So they were pretty much suckered into firing on the fleet and Fort Sumter, which is what Lincoln wanted. And then Lincoln sent out this order to all the other states that they had to turn their state militias over to the United States government. And he was calling for 75,000 Army volunteers, and I've heard anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000 Navy personnel to fight this war against these seven states that would not come back into the Union. And when that happened, then six more states said, we're out of here also. So Lincoln was really responsible for almost doubling the size of the Confederate States of America. And I know Governor Isom G. Harris of Tennessee sent a letter to Lincoln, said, we will not furnish one single man for coercion, but 50,000 if necessary to defend our rights and those of our fellow Southern states. So Tennessee wasn't out of the Union yet. It didn't secede until June of 1862, but he flat out told him, even if they were technically still in the Union, they weren't furnishing troops to invade the other Southern states. And the funny thing about it was, read some of the notes about that, he had first put 75,000 in there and said, we will furnish 75,000 if necessary. And he scratched it out and put 50,000. He thought 75 was a little over the top. He should have left it. Because yes. Tennessee furnished 132,000 men to the Confederate Army. And Dang. They did furnish some out of East Tennessee to the Federal Army as well. So anyway, that was just some of the background of what happened with the Confederate government. And then, of course, when they moved the government up to Richmond, then the government of the Confederacy was officially put in place, the official government, not the provisional government, but the official government, on February 22nd, 1862. And Nancy was talking about this, about the Great Seal of the Confederacy that has the rendering of the George Washington equestrian statue, which is on the monument there on the Capitol grounds in Richmond. And February 22nd being George Washington's birthday, they wanted to tie in between this new country and the father of the old country, George Washington. So on the Confederate seal, you have 22 February 1862, and then the equestrian statue of George Washington and some of the agricultural products of the South. And then right at the bottom of it is the Latin phrase Deo Vindici, which means God vindicates, like on the United States seal where they have the buzzard holding the arrows and the Yankee shield and all of their stuff on there. And it says, E pluribus unum, out of many one, or something like that. Or everybody, you know, the southern border's open and anybody can get in. I think that's what it means, or something like that. Anyway, so that was the Confederate seal, and that was all adopted and made as the permanent Confederate government in February of 1862. Now, some of the other events that we were talking about, some of the battles that were fought, there were two battles that were fought in Tennessee in February. When Grant and Admiral Foote and the Federal Navy were coming up the rivers into Tennessee to invade Tennessee, and the Federal gunboats attacked Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, and that was very poorly designed. They put a lot of their artillery right down close to the river, and some of the people around there were telling them, I said, look, up there in that tree, see where that brush is up in that tree? That's where the river's going to be if there's a flood. You don't need to build it down this close to the water. And sure enough, the Confederates at Fort Henry really didn't fight much of a battle because the Yankee gunboats just rolled on the river that was rising right into Fort Henry. And Lloyd Tillman from Kentucky fired some of the shots and then delayed them long enough for the rest of the troops to get out of Fort Henry and make their way across country over to toward Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River. Now, Grant and his infantry never got involved in Fort Henry. That was in early February. They were trying to unload them downriver from Fort Henry, and they were going to march a few miles on land and surround the fort and capture all the Confederates there. Well, Grant and his troops got stuck in the mud and the swamp water, and they never even got close to Fort Henry. It was the Federal Navy that actually just had the gunboats just ride right into the fort because the Tennessee River was coming up so high.
Dang.
So we will finish that up and talk a little bit about the battle at Fort Donelson in Dover, Tennessee.
Yes, we will. As soon as we come back from this break. Be right back, folks.
Have you ever heard of Loving Liberty Ladies? Well, the Loving Liberty Ladies are here to help you learn our American heritage and the way it affects today's society. The Loving Liberty Ladies also have a discussion guide called Proclaim Liberty. And with this guide, you can start your own group in your hometown. Get yours today on our website at lovingliberty.net. Look for our lesson supplements, too. They're free. To hear all the special offers and to join the fight for freedom and liberty, please go to lovingliberty.net.
I'm Michael Hill, President of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C., and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Excuse me, Captain. I know this may sound silly, but can you fly?
Nope. Never had a lesson.
Yes, indeed, you Dear Blood River Radio family, I cannot believe this is the last segment of the last hour, but Gene is bringing up some very interesting points. I mean, that what they found these nuggets of history that you cannot find anywhere else. But I just asked Gene a question during the break, and so did Nancy. So we're going to turn it back over to Gene, the bitter ender, and he's going to continue on with this history lesson. Go ahead, Gene.
Well, Nancy brought up a point that the reason they didn't build Fort Henry on the western side of the Tennessee River and up on higher ground a little further downriver because that was in Kentucky. Fort Henry's in Tennessee, but that's right close to the border. And if you look at a map, Tennessee, the northern border runs east and west, and then all of a sudden it jumps up and goes up north a few miles and then continues going east as the border with Kentucky. So that part where they could have built the fort on the western side at that time was part of, well, it's still part of Kentucky, but Kentucky was trying to be neutral then. And by the time the Yankees had invaded and had taken over Paducah and Bishop Polk and the Confederates had taken over Columbus on the Mississippi, it was too late to get the fort built on the western side or the higher ground of the Tennessee River. So they were stuck pretty much with Fort Henry. And like we were talking about earlier, it just flooded out. So there wasn't much they could do about that. And then I think you had another question, Eddie, on...
Yes, I was going to ask... It's been a long time since I hit Tennessee history. Gene, I think Tennessee was divided with the eastern part of Tennessee.
Oh, the division of Tennessee, yeah.
Correct, and
now,
probably Kentucky.
Tennessee voted to get out of the Union, and it was overwhelming in West Tennessee, and there's probably not quite unanimous in Middle Tennessee, but I'd say 80% yes for secession and no. And then I always heard that East Tennessee was very pro-Union. But in actuality, if you go back and check it, there were Confederate regiments that were raised in East Tennessee. And the reason being that it depended on the county you were in. If the county had voted Whig, which later became Republican, they're probably pro-Union. And if the county had voted Democrat in most of the elections, then it was probably pro-secession or pro-Southern. So you couldn't draw a line right straight down the Cumberland Plateau and say, okay, everything to the east of that is pro-Union and everything to the west of that is pro-Confederate. There were a lot of places that were split up by politics prior to the war. So that's why there was so much division in East Tennessee, that, you know, one county was pro-secession because they were Democrat, had voted Democrat, and the other one was Whig, and so they were probably pro-Union. So, and there were Union units that were raised out of East Tennessee. It was like Northern Alabama. There were parts of Northern Alabama that were pro-Union. And they had not a lot, but some federal units that were raised out of Northern Alabama. So, and usually there was a lot of, there wasn't a whole lot of pro-secession sentiment in the mountains. You know, a lot of Western Virginia was divided, and it eventually became the state of West Virginia. And in Western North Carolina, there was not a lot of pro-Southern sentiment, or pro-secession sentiment. And same thing in East Tennessee. So right down through that mountain chain there was where a lot of the pro-Union activities took place. So anyway, we were talking about February and the battles that were fought in Tennessee. So Fort Henry really wasn't a battle. The Tennessee River won that battle. It just flooded the fort out. And then Grant, finally, a day or so after the Navy got there, he showed up. And then they decided, well, it's all over here. So rather than getting back on the steamboats and going down the Tennessee River and then turning up the Ohio and up the Cumberland, was going to march overland. That's that land between the rivers there, or it's land between the lakes now, and just march overland to Fort Donelson at Dover, Tennessee, on the Cumberland River. Only problem was he ran into a cavalry detachment. Nobody had ever heard of this guy before. He wasn't a West Pointer. He wasn't famous. He wasn't a big politician. He was just a businessman in Memphis, and he volunteered for the Confederate Army as a private. But he was a very successful businessman, worth about $1.5 million back then, which is worth about $40 to $50 million today. And in Bidenomics, it's probably worth about $200 million.
Yes,
but anyway, the unknown lieutenant colonel was Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he harassed Grant. All that, I think it's about 15 miles from the Tennessee over to the Cumberland River. And he harassed them, and ambushes and snipers picking off, and for 2 days, and slowed Grant down getting across there. And this was not the first time that Forrest had caused some headaches for Grant, and it wouldn't be the last time either. So Grant's army gets over to Fort Donelson and on the Cumberland River, and they decided that they were just going to let the gunboat steam up the Cumberland River and take it out, just like they'd taken out Fort Henry, except it didn't work that well. Fort Donelson was laid out a lot better. It was up on high ground. And the gunners with the heavy guns up there on the top, they were firing down on the federal gunboats. And every battle where the Confederates had plunging fire, where they were shooting down on federal ships, they tore up the federal Navy. They did at Fort Donelson. They did at Drury's Bluff on the James River down below Richmond. So that was the advantage that they had, and they just beat the federal gunboats to pieces. And a lot of them were, the steering devices were shot away, and they were just drifting down the Cumberland River out of range.
Golly.
And Admiral Foote, shell exploded and ripped off part of the boards on the inside of his flagship. And one of these big pieces of wood hit him in the side of the head, knocked him goofy. He didn't know, after that, he didn't know a battle was going on. So then Grant's men tried a couple of land assaults against the fort. They were beaten back. And the Confederates decided, and this is in the middle of February now, February 14th, they decided they were going to break out of the fort. and surprise the Yankees at dawn the next morning and break out and get on the road to Clarksville and escape. They didn't want to be trapped in that fort in a siege and be starved out of there. So sure enough, that morning of February 14th. Oh, and here's another thing that happened. While Grant's men were marching from Fort Henry across that little neck of land, it was unusually hot. And we know how that is in Tennessee. You can have 70 degrees yes. one day and be out there in shorts and T-shirts. And then that night, the cold north wind comes in and you're freezing. Well, that's what happened. A lot of these Yankees had these big heavy overcoats for a winter campaign. They threw them away. They said, we're in the sunny South. We're not carrying all this extra Uh-oh. Weight. And they just pitched these overcoats off in the ditch alongside the road. Well, that night, you know how it is in Tennessee, the storm yes. came in, and it dropped from like the 70s down into the 20s and teens. And now these guys are trying to dig in around Fort Donelson, and they're lighting fires to try to stay warm because they just got their regular wool coats and normal cotton shirts. And they got rid of their overcoats. They didn't want to carry them. So they're lighting fires to try to stay warm, and Confederate snipers are aiming at these fires and just a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right of the fire and picking off these Yankee soldiers out there. So they got to put the fires out because now the snipers are picking them off. So that didn't go real well. So anyway, morning of the 14th, the Confederates decide they're going to break out and escape, get to Clarksville or to Nashville. And, of course, leading the attack was the cavalry under Bedford Forrest out on the flank. And Forrest captured quite a number of prisoners and artillery. And they caught Grant completely off guard. And they just bent the Federal lines back into a real sharp V. Now they had a second option, throw everybody into the attack and push Grant back over the bluff and down into the Cumberland River. But the West Point generals and the political hacks that were running the fort there came up with a third option. They decided of course, the road was open now to Clarksville. That was option number one. Option number two is throw everybody into the attack and drive Grant over the bluff and into the Cumberland River, and that's what Forrest was pushing for. But he was only a lieutenant colonel, and he wasn't a West Pointer, so he didn't know anything, of course. They were the big, yeah. big bugs. So, the big hotshots came up with a third option. They turned around, went back into the fort, and then that night they decided to surrender. And they called Forrest in, not to get his opinion, but just to tell him, we're going to surrender the fort tomorrow morning, and your cavalry's going to be surrendered. And he said, I didn't bring my men here to surrender. We're going out of here tonight. This was about midnight. He told him, well, my scouts have been out on the road, and they say the road's open. Well, we don't think it is. We see campfires out there. So he sent his scouts out again, and they said, yeah, they're campfires, but it's the Federal wounded. And they set some of the brush on fire just trying to stay warm and not freeze to death out here because it had snowed, and ice and snow was on the ground. Mm. They said, the road's still open. So they came back and told them that about 2:30 or 3 o'clock. A.M. and they said, no, it's too cold. We can't do that. We'd have to wade through the creek, and it's, you know, hypothermia or exposure, they called it back then. And Forrest said, well, I didn't bring my men here to surrender. We're going out of here tonight, even if you have to bust hell wide open to do it. So he got all of his, about 600 men in his battalion, and some of the infantry found out that they were getting out of there, so they asked if they could ride double with them, and they said, yeah, swing up behind and climb up behind here. And they got through Dover and got to Lick Creek right outside Dover and crossed it and got away. Forrest did not surrender.
That's incredible. I cannot believe they were going to surrender that fort that easily. Well, Gene, I guess you hear the music. Miss Nancy?
Yes, sir.
We'll have to finish this story, what's left of it, on the next time we come, which will be with the 2nd of March. February will be gone. Well, thank you so much, Gene and Miss Nancy, for coming on and making this program go like it is. And thank you, Miss Lizzie, for keeping me straight all night. Thank you, Blood River Radio. Thank you, Fred and Mona. God bless all you people out there. God willing, we'll see you same time, same place in the next month. Good night, everybody.